And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And we are back after a week away for Thanksgiving. Today on the show, you may have heard that there is a movie starring some Muppets.
And that movie is called Martha Marcy. That actually stands for Muppet, 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 yeah, Muppet. Yeah.
So we are going to start off today talking a little bit about the Muppets, about presumably nostalgia, music, childhood, wonder, joy. And we're going to talk a little bit about how pop culture can help you find common ground, let's say, with the diverse members of your party, if such a thing is possible. And then, of course, as always, what is making us happy this week, which, you know, we like to close on a happy note. Stephen Thompson, speaking of beginning on a happy note, what do you do at NPR?
Well, I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I mostly edit movies coverage, although this week I owe Stephen Thompson a little music blurb that I'm way past deadline.
Yes. Actually, you are excused from this taping to go write it.
Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And we should also mention that we have prepared to step in at a moment's notice our esteemed producer, Mike Katzeff, who is always around to help us out a little bit when we need someone who is not our exact age.
I hear he's he's proficient with the old skateboard.
Exactly.
He's got a slingshot in his back pocket.
Exactly. And when we talked about topics for today, he said, Muppets? What are Muppets?
Exactly. Yeah. That's how we like to think of him. So you will also be hearing from Mike, and you'll know him by his esteemed nature, which oozes from him. Oh. So the Muppets. Now, Stephen, I saw this movie when you saw it.
That's right.
I have a sense of how you responded to it.
I'm trying to figure out exactly how you were able to sort of sense my thoughts on the movie. Was it the fact that I had balled up my tiny little fists and gone while pausing occasionally to use one of my puddly little fists to wipe away tears?
Yeah, uh-huh.
I just assume you did Kermit arms for most of the movie.
I did flappity Kermit arms for much of the movie. I understand that it is not a perfect movie. I understand that there are curmudgeons who have taken to the Twitter to tweet their disappointment in this movie, and they can all cram it with walnuts, because I felt that this movie was made entirely out of love and felt. thus I just thought it was delightful. I felt that Jason Segel, the human male lead in this movie, the non-felt male lead in this movie, who also co-wrote it
and sort of headed up the project,
sort of helped shepherd it,
got it going, yeah. and was sort of the champion of it at the beginning,
and you know, is very much sort of the human identity, I guess, of the franchise at this point, now that Jim Henson
and
is 20
really
years
just
gone.
Kind of ideal casting. It would have been so different without him in the role. He's just agreeable. I think Linda described him as Muppety in her review. And he is. It's a really good word. He's cheerful and unthreatening and happy-making in the same slightly woeful way that Kermit is. Mm-hmm.
He is Muppety. And I actually felt that all of the primary human cast of this movie was Muppety in his or her own way. Amy Adams is basically a Muppet in girl form.
That's true.
Chris Cooper, Tex Richmond, the oil baron, the cruel oil baron, seriously looked like a Muppet. He looked more Muppety than he's ever
looked.
That's
true. He did look especially Muppety in this role. Now, the Chris Cooper, let's say, musical number has been polarizing. There are people who found it so cringeworthy that they were crawling out of their seats. I personally thought it was so obviously intended to be ridiculous that I took it on those terms and it did not bother me.
I responded the exact same way. I responded to it the way I responded to a lot of the sort of meta gags in the movie. One of the movies that it reminded me of actually a little bit is, in terms of sensibility, is Wayne's World, where it sort of did a certain amount of that kind of commenting on itself and sort of using as a shortcut, sort of commenting on itself as a way of getting, like where either Statler or Waldorf sort of says, well, that sounds like an important plot point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do the exposition work right up front.
Where they do a certain amount of exposition work and cheat around, like how do they get from place to place? Well, they travel by map, you know?
Yeah. And the joke where Amy Adams says, this is going to be a really short movie.
Yeah. Right.
The original Muppet movie had a certain amount of that stuff itself. There's a scene in the original Muppet movie where Kermit catches Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem up on the story by giving them the script to read so that they can understand what's happened so far.
Yeah, but what brings you dudes here?
Kermit here, he was living in the swamp,
Fozzie,
and then a fisherman came along.
Fozzie, you can't tell him the whole story. You'll bore the audience.
Oh, sorry. But Kermit, the band here wants to know.
Well, let him read the screenplay.
Ah, yes, sir. You see, it starts here on page one.
The Muppet Movie, huh? Let's see. Exterior swamp day. In a long helicopter shot, we discover Kermit the Frog playing his banjo and singing. A Hollywood agent starts the frog traveling west. Kermit and Fozzie come walking down the aisle to the thunderously loud music of Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem, which am us.
For sure. Yeah, for sure.
This is a narrative of very heavy-duty proportion.
So that's nothing new
right.
for this.
I'm not going to defend Chris Cooper's rap because it is indefensible. but the arrangement is hilariously dated, but it comes with exactly what you were mentioning. There's a fidelity to it because they stopped making Muppet movies for a brief period, ending in 1984 with Muppets Take Manhattan. Rap broke through to the mainstream, what, around 85, 86? So if they had made a rap movie in 1987, 88, there would have been a rap number in it, and it would have sounded exactly as toothless and safe and egregiously white as this particular rap number did. They knew exactly what they were going for.
Well, I mean, you have to keep... I mean, Brett McKenzie from Flight of the Conchords wrote many of the songs. I don't know if he actually wrote the rap.
Yeah.
But the fact that they have Brett McKenzie writing the songs, they know exactly...
Oh, sure, yeah.
They nobody
on,
thought, like, this will be totally dope.
It's a rap
totally
number
dope.
With Vegas showgirls.
Yeah, that's also kind of threw me off a little
bit. Well, exactly. The only rap you're ever going to see with Vegas showgirls is one that is hilariously ill-pitched. So, to me, the combination of the fact that it's like... Who would expect Chris Cooper to start rapping in the middle of a movie?
Just like he did in Lone Star?
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And it's the same thing with the jokes about maniacal laugh. It's just, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's really fun and weird. And so the rap did not bother me. How about you, Trey Graham? How did you feel about The Muppets?
I thought it was great fun. I actually have just come from the screening as we tape this, and I found myself charmed by the small touches. You know, the call-outs to things I recognize, the minor characters who drifted by in backgrounds and never really got a whole lot of exposure in the main plot line. And to circle back to the point of meta-commentary, they comment on that when they're gathering the gang. They find themselves all together, and then there's a comment on how everybody got in the car. I like that kind of thing, because you can only do so much earnest, straightforward, heartwarming storytelling before my throat begins to close up.
Right.
And so there.
I agree. Glenn Weldon, how about you, Muppets?
Well, I know you people. I know you're thinking that I'm going to come in here and Statler and or Waldorf come up in this piece. You think I'm going to rain on your little Muppety mellow here? But I am not your show monkey. I have layers. And I dug it. I dug it a lot.
Yeah.
It's not that it so much snuck past my defenses as it kind of was grandfathered in. Because when I watched this with my family and was a very young boy, of course, it was before life had beaten all the joy and hope out of me.
Right.
So it felt, watching this thing, very familiar. Like, I kept hearing this voice going, the calls are coming from inside your heart. You know, it felt like... It felt disconcerting. What it got, and this is what I think is the hardest thing to get, is the tone. Tone is something that we react to almost viscerally. Mm-hmm. We react to it before we think about it and sort of parse it. So it's a visceral response. And the Muppety tone is a combination of earnest, silly, certainly not ironic, but I would venture to say that there's some sardonic humor in it.
Yeah.
Gently sardonic.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, Trey, sadness. There's a melancholy to it, but there's also, you know, occasionally some flashes of darkness. It was great to see Marvin Suggs and the Muppaphone again after the thing where the xylophone
were
yes. Catch that. You can hear Brent McKenzie in these songs in a big way. Am I a Man or a Muppet is the most Flight of the Conchords song I have ever heard. It is more Flight of the Conchords-y than anything. Do you guys remember when there's two exactly points in this movie where you hear Jim Henson's voice? Do you remember what they are?
Well, yeah, when they first go into the theater, because they play an old clip of Kermit introducing Bob Hope.
Yep.
And then
there's
when
one with
they...
Steve Martin.
There's Steve Martin, too.
And when they do the intro, the other one...
is Menomina at the end, over the end credits. That's the actual...
Is that the original?
That's the original.
Sure.
That's the thing, yeah. That's the actual... So the stumbling block here, the potential stumbling block, was the character of Walter, who has the potential to be a classic Mary Sue.
Yeah.
A classic Scrappy-Doo.
A Cousin Oliver.
A Cousin Oliver. A Poochie.
A Poochie.
Of course. The closest they came to that is at the end scene. We're going to spoil this a little bit.
No.
Okay.
No spoiling.
All right.
Love the end scene.
Well, okay, I take your point, Trey, because, I mean, this film trades on the laughter of recognition more than any film that I've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
Like just, you know, seeing a cameo appearance, like more so than any film, I think, since Moulin Rouge, you know, your reaction And recognizing something is, I found,
especially in the big ensemble dance numbers, I found myself not looking at, say, Jason Segel and
Amy Adams.
I'm looking for the cameos, right?
Well, and I will say, since you already mentioned the Man or the Muppet, the cameo in the Man or a Muppet without busting it for anybody, it's so perfect. You don't know it until you see it.
Absolutely.
And then you think that's the only thing they could have done.
I might have squealed a little bit with glee.
Yeah.
There were young kids sitting right behind me, and they obviously thought they were at a Wiggles show because they were, you know, standing up in the aisle and they were clapping along and they were singing out loud. Didn't mind it because whenever there was a ballad or a slow talky part, those kids were like, "Mommy, I gotta pee. Daddy, I need popcorn." So they were basically my unfettered id. Because at some point in this movie, let's admit it, you needed to metaphorically pee.
Yes. There are slow parts.
There are slow parts.
One of the interesting things, beyond just how good the movie is or isn't, I guess what I would say is there's more than one way in which this is a movie about intellectual property. Right?
you think?
You know, obviously it has an internal storyline about intellectual property. It has an internal storyline about the right to be the Muppets, right?
I wanted to see a half-an-hour show starring the Muppets, personally myself.
But at the same time, it really does raise an interesting question about to whom do characters like this belong once they have been in the culture for long enough? Because there was some, you know, talk in the press that Frank Oz and a couple of other people had sort of, you know, poo-pooed the script and it was too much about the Jason Segel character. And at some point you just realize that you can't make movies for people who are not working on them, who have moved on, who are doing other things. You're never going to make a Jim Henson movie after Jim Henson is gone. The best thing you can do is find another way to sort of keep those characters alive. And the thing that was sort of thrilling to me was that this was the first time since Jim Henson died that I have been able to see Kermit and feel like it was Kermit.
Yes.
It doesn't sound exactly the same. There are a couple characters that sound, you know, more different than others. I think Piggy sounds just like Piggy. Fozzie sounds a little weird to me.
Yeah.
It registers a little bit. But the personality of Kermit, to me, watching this movie, that was Kermit. I forgot about it.
The deftness of the physical performance in particular, the subtlety of the puppeteering.
The manipulation of the
face.
Really
extraordinary,
You're not trying to make the same movie Jim Henson would have made, because first of all, that's impossible. Second of all, it's kind of, in a way, more disrespectful to say, I'm making a Jim Henson movie without Jim Henson, than it is to say, look, these are characters that sort of belong to everybody after a certain point. And if you're respectful about it, I mean, there are certainly ways of exploiting and dishonoring and things like that. But if you are doing it with absolute love and absolute dedication and happiness, it's possible to do something that isn't exactly what Jim Henson would have done, that might have some differences to the way that they did it. And yes, it's true. When he was making the movies didn't have so many people in them. But at the same time, it's like you can't freeze characters in time if there's still lots and lots of life in them. Because part of what made Jim Henson's death so sad, I think, for a lot of people, was it felt like all those characters died at the same time. Yeah, right. And when you suddenly feel like Ernie died, you're like, can Kermit the Frog really die? You know, is it okay for somebody else at some point? And I know, you know, Glenn has had this experience with tons and tons of comic book characters who exist as a creative product of one person, and eventually somebody takes over. And obviously that can be a disaster, and it can make you feel like it's been dishonored, but I don't think it has to.
I know I was devastated when Waylon Flowers died and I realized that Madam would be no more.
When Jim Henson died, I remember talking to my friend Dan and having his response be, "Oh no, Jim Henson died." When he realized that Kermit had died, he burst into tears. Mm-hmm. I remember that reaction really, really well.
Yeah.
I appreciate what you're saying, and in part, it gives one answer to a question that I had. And I think that a question that comes out of seeing this movie inevitably, and I do not feel I can answer it. I feel that only posterity can answer it. I feel that only Muppet historians in some far future time could answer it.
So try.
That's right.
Hi-ho.
The question is this: what is this film doing? Let me take it back to a specific scene, the scene where they recreate the opening theme. So these images, this music, which is in your head, has been living in your head for years. All of a sudden, you see it for the first time played out on the big screen. You know exactly what's coming next. You recognize every shot. It's a shot-for-shot remake.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That feeling that you get in your chest is just pure joy. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as it's over, it feels a little empty. Mm-hmm. A little bit. So I'm going to say, I'll keep this clean for NPR, but there is a certain onanistic, shall we say,
oh, good
pleasure
God.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm not alone in this,
no,
right?
No,
you're
no,
talking
no,
about
that's fair.
You're talking about as a viewer.
Right. It's the joy of like instant nostalgia.
So it's
boom.
Not the yeah. it's not the movie being onanistic. It is as a viewer,
yes, I guess
you are being pleasured.
Yes.
It's not really onanistic, then. The movie is providing
I don't like where this train of thought is going, so I would like... But,
okay, yeah,
but it's an interesting idea.
Let me put it this way.
Is where we need to talk to Mike Katzeff.
Yeah.
We need to ask
because
Mike
that's
Katzeff,
what I want
to, how it lands.
That scene is not meant to stand by itself. It's meant to feed on your memories. Mm-hmm. It can't stand alone. It's not meant to stand alone.
How does it stand alone? If you've never seen The Muppet Show before, it's still a show-stopping number.
What a good way to segue into Mike Katzeff's reaction.
This is where we thought it would be very valuable to have the perspective of somebody who perhaps did not grow up on The Muppet Show when it was live and new, as the rest of us, I think, all did. So Mike Katzeff, here to represent your entire age cohort, talk to me a little bit about how you reacted to the sort of a nostalgia movie that's nostalgic for something that has sort of always been nostalgia for you, right? I mean, in terms of the fact that it was kind of around before you were around.
Hi. I almost disagree that just because it is nostalgic for you doesn't mean it's not nostalgic for, you know, people of my age, people younger, because mm-hmm. there are Muppets in all sorts of different formats besides just The Muppet Show from yeah. that era, right? Just because it died for you at a certain point doesn't mean there were not other Muppet movies that were made in the 90s that uh-huh. kids grew up with. Muppet Babies, which people grew up with and loved. There was a rebirth, and not a particularly successful rebirth, of The Muppet Show that was on ABC, I think, at some point. So I think for a lot of people, because so much of this movie is about being reintroduced to those characters again, maybe it was off the shelf for you for way longer, but for other people it was off the shelf for 5-10 years or so. Mm-hmm. And so it has the feeling of always being nostalgic, and the show itself is sort of nostalgic just because it's a model of television or a model of movie, a variety show, a comedy,
you know,
sing-alongs and musicals. All that naturally just feels nostalgic anyway.
That's a great point
that it starts out as a nostalgia piece to begin with, even as an original show, because it was very much
playing off variety.
Yeah,
well,
it was like a vaudeville theater.
And the movie, particularly the first movie, is very much an old MGM musical, and they used to do musical numbers that were modeled off of specific mm-hmm. types of musical numbers that would have shown up in a Judy Garland movie.
And if you remember Muppets Take Manhattan, which I think is the third one of all those, mm-hmm. I can't remember. More or less, a lot of the same plot. They disperse, and then they get back together. They have, you know, that Magnificent Seven type scene, or that Ocean's 11 scene, where they're getting the band back mm-hmm. together. They had that in that movie and in this movie. It's, you know, in and of itself, seeing them all get back together is part of the thing, whether
yeah.
you're 5 years old, or whether you're, you know, in your 20s, or whether you're, you know, you grew up with it, you know, when it was actually on.
Right.
For me, like things like Star Wars or the 70s Superman movies or whatever, they always just existed. And so it never felt nostalgic because I knew that it existed. You just watched it in reruns. You didn't know that it was necessarily old or new or whatever. It also, I feel like the whole movie sort of mirrored the idea that Disney kind of purposely left them on the shelf. They neglected it and ignored the franchise once they bought it because they didn't really know what to do. They kind of had a couple stinker movies in a row and then didn't really know how to do it. And so they almost purposely left it off the shelf for maybe even longer. Yeah. So it built something back into it, a longing for these characters again. And you kind of seen these characters getting peppered in here and there on talk shows and mm-hmm. on the Today Show and on these various things, because they're trying to just slowly integrate them up to the point where there's like almost a demand for these characters again.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about how savvy the marketing campaign for this movie was. There was a structured 2-year social media and mm-hmm. and multimedia marketing campaign.
Yeah.
Around this movie.
Mike, how did you feel about the movie generally? Did you enjoy it?
I liked most of it. I would give it an A, but maybe like an A minus, you know, whatever. The things that bugged me maybe didn't bug other people. And I think the two things that I would say were my two biggest complaints, and one I can sort of back up and explain, and one I just didn't like. So the first one is several people, including myself, were sort of put off initially by them doing modern songs, like the chicken version of
the CeeLo song. Seriously?
So I thought that was...
It does instantly date the movie.
Yes and no. What I was thinking was initially it felt like it was going to date the movie. It was going to insert... you know, it's sort of like the Chipmunks version of like a Lady Gaga song, it, whatever, which was a trailer that we saw.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it was.
The more I thought about it, though, I can actually get behind that because you
the,
know,
the Chipmunks doing single ladies.
No.
The more I thought about how the Muppet Show, the show, you know, when it was first on, was, and how this movie is, I think compared to the other movies, maybe it inserted too much kind of modern song that are going to potentially date the movie. But if you surf around YouTube or get the DVD sets of The Muppet Show, it's littered with music from that era. Elton John, Paul Simon, Alice Cooper. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, the entire series is just filled with music. And obviously celebrities of that era, too, that are going to, you know, some feel dated and some feel totally classic. Like, man, I can't believe they got John Cleese or Luke Skywalker or whatever.
Yeah.
But we also have the benefit of time of knowing those are really classic appearances.
Right.
And classic performances of those songs.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
welcome to my nightmare, man. I mean, yeah,
right.
Cooper.
Right.
Rita Moreno
30.
Doing Fever.
Right. And Elton John singing Benny and the Jets with the Muppets is classic and great. That also dates that era of that Muppet Show, but it also makes it classic.
So what you're saying
is I think
is
the
that
problem is with the CeeLo song, because we're living in the era where that CeeLo song is only like a year, 18 months old, it feels a little bit more ubiquitous. It's been on Glee and it's been elsewhere or whatever. But I think 20 years from now,
it'll be in the canon along with We Built This City.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Because seriously, we're going. That is. I feel like it's the elephant in the room.
It really kind of is. It was such a classic montage number, but
it was a great montage. I thought the scenes itself
but
were great.
The idea of subjecting the audience to that song is almost criminal.
Well, I think it does bring up a larger point about We Built This City, and I realize that We Built This City.
Yes, let's take that tangent.
I feel like the song We Built This City is on an arc that I myself would like to pursue, which is to be so awful for so long that you attain a kind of meta awesomeness.
Right.
Journey.
This movie
sort of
is certainly trying to make that happen.
And we have to go back to Mike because you had another thing. You had the one thing was
no.
The songs.
Okay.
And then I want to
the
let
second
Mike
thing
finish,
that will actually
Steven.
Date this movie. If you're trying to make a movie that is going to be classic for 20 years, that you want people to rewatch over and over and over again, the cameos are the thing that bugged me way, way more.
Really?
I mean, let's be honest. There's three different types of casting of the humans. There's the ones that are actually given characters or lines, things
right.
like that. There are the ones that are stunt casting, like, hey, it's that person just playing
right.
the waitress
right.
or whatever,
right.
or
right.
the hobo.
Right.
And then there's the ones where you just point and say, hey, it's that guy.
Yeah.
You know? And there's plenty of them. And in the telethon scene, that whole scene is littered with those where, like, hey, it's that person. And you're going to wonder way longer, well, why are they there? It's a wasted opportunity for a lot of them, especially one who particularly works on a certain sitcom with the main lead of the show. Like,
yes, it is.
Use him.
That wasn't wasted.
It was wasted.
it had a joke.
On the
they
other
had
hand.
A joke.
Strong joke.
They
on the
sort
other
of.
Hand, in when you're doing your first movie musical style extravaganza number, and you cut to a park bench, and there's a face no one under 40 will recognize, but is one of the great faces in the history of movies, and Trey, who is 43, gasps and falls out of his seats. I say score.
I mean,
no,
I think
I don't
the cameos
know. I mean,
function like jokes in movies. I mean, if you think about the movies like The Naked Gun, where there are constantly
there are
jokes,
so many of them.
There are jokes happening in the background, there are jokes happening in the foreground, and as you're watching along, your eyes are never necessary. I mean, not that there aren't slow scenes in this movie, but you're less likely to get bored when you have these kind of snap, 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 snap.
That
you know,
I totally
person,
get.
Sometimes a face is a joke in this movie.
You could say that like the photos on the wall in Kermit's office are almost cameos. Like, hey, I remember that episode of the show. You know, there's Steve Martin on the wall. It almost made me think, man, wouldn't it be great if Steve Martin showed up. Instead, we get, you know, random kids from sitcoms that happen to be particularly famous right now.
I think you're right. I think some of the cameos,
it's going to feel like, who's that kid? You know, 20 years from now,
did they happen to be ABC or Disney properties?
I think you're right that some of the cameos will prove to be a little bit lightweight compared to what you would ideally have. If you think back about the Muppet movie, the original Muppet movie, I do think this movie used cameos in a very similar way, but the people were a little bit different because in the first Muppet movie, you had people like Steve Martin and Carol Kane doing the myth, where she keeps popping out. It was cameos that I think were a little bit more about using kind of heavyweight movie stars. And some of the cameos in this movie are like that. But more
some of them totally worked, and others were just like,
more of them are a little bit, you know, very much aimed at this exact moment in time. I agree with you that the cameos are...
So those are my two complaints. Yeah. Otherwise, I just thought it was a very lovely movie. I was just really pumped to see some of those characters again. Yeah. I kind of wish some of my favorites were featured a little bit more.
Yeah.
I wish that maybe the animal no drumming thing had maybe a better payoff or more dramatic thing.
Agreed.
But... it was awesome. It was just totally great. And my, you know, my entire family went.
And I know that that Glenn has commented on a fact that a couple of other people on my Twitter feed have commented on, which is that, boy, that first big musical number, that's a catchy one. That'll that'll stick with you.
Well, they do bring it back at the end.
Mm-hmm. They do, and it's just enough to make it stick.
I will be curious to see what if there's a director's cut of this movie that restores some of the scenes that were clearly cut. There's a song on the soundtrack that I believe it's The Rap that has a whole extra verse that refers to it, what is obviously a cutout plot point. And I wonder if there weren't other scenes that were deemed slow. One of the big final payoffs in the movie doesn't necessarily have a whole lot of build up to it. There's not really any foreshadowing to it. Yeah. I think there's another good 10-15 minutes lying around waiting to pop up on a DVD somewhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was funny. Mike mentioned that this movie, to this movie, he went with the entire family, grandma down to whoever. And that happens to bring us to the other thing we were going to talk about today, which is family holidays often bring you together with many different relatives with many different diverse tastes. And it's always challenging to figure out how to keep, well, everyone in the room or everyone that you want to stay in the room, in the room. Because I want to, you know, I want to make it clear that there's a time and a place for polarizing entertainment. Where you might say, oh, I'm sorry, Grandma. I'd love to keep talking to you, but I got this really, really important, like, I don't know.
Fargo. Real,
I got this,
we all have to watch Fargo.
I have this really important, very violent movie that I have to watch for work. You know?
It's kind of the equivalent of The Wedding, where it starts out with oldies and kind of quickly works its way to what the young people dance to.
But there is also a time and place for finding things that everybody can enjoy or at least tolerate and have a good time and it doesn't start fights. And so we were going to talk about pop culture and common ground. Glenn Weldon, talk to me a little bit about common ground.
Well, no, this is a no-brainer for me. There's one thing and one thing only that will bring everybody together of all different ages and races and political and sexual bents that are in your family. And, you know, some people are going to think that I'm going to be talking about a game called Celebrity. I am aware of its work, Celebrity. At its heart, Celebrity is, let's admit it, charades. Mm-hmm. And charades involve standing up in front of a bunch of people while they all look at you, while you perform a little thing.
Not everybody wants to do that.
I am not a fan of that. It's like somebody made a game out of that moment when you first walk into a party and all eyes are turned to you and judge you.
And you don't know anyone.
Right. Let's make a game of this.
You know, if you had asked me whether Glenn Weldon would be a big fan of playing Celebrity, I would have said, I bet not.
Here's what I like. The dictionary game. Some know it as the board game Balderdash.
Yes.
But that is just Mattel Toys taking what is at heart a simple, honest, pure, good, and true game and painting it up like a harlot.
Uh-huh.
And charging you money for it. All you need...
Like a harlot.
As a harlot would. All you need with dictionary is paper, pencils, and a good dictionary, an unabridged dictionary.
Uh-huh.
Here's how it works. The picker picks a word, reads the word out, and spells it for everybody. The picker writes down the real definition and throws it into a hat or a mixing bowl or whatever. Everyone writes down a fake but plausible-sounding definition. They go into the hat, and the definitions are read aloud at random, after which everyone votes on what they think the real definition is. You get a point for each person who guesses your answer. You get 1 or 2 points, depending on house rules, for guessing the right answer, and the picker gets 3 points if no one guesses the right answer at all. So then the picker passes the dictionary on. Here's why it is universal and superior to Celebrity. Celebrity is Facebook. The dictionary game is Twitter.
Right.
It's that old people versus language dichotomy born out again, and you know which one you'd prefer.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, the dictionary game admits nuance and rewards cunning. So you can... You can bluff people out by voting for your own definition that you wrote down. When you're picking, you can do that thing where you pretend you can't read the handwriting to kind of fake people out.
Sure.
You can do that thing. It's like, so it's a reproductive bud produced by some marine Spoons? Sponges. Sorry, sponges.
Because you wrote it, but
because
you're pretending.
You wrote it. See what I'm doing there? It is capable of either refuting or confirming your opinion of other people in the room. So when Uncle Dave picks a word like quietude, because he's never heard it before.
You judge.
You can kind of say, okay, well, he's a dumb guy. He's
so,
a dumb guy.
Because
no. it's right there in the word.
So it's not that this is this game has less judging. It's
no,
just
God
that,
forbid.
It's just that this is a game in which they're less likely to judge you.
Right. Also, no, that's not necessarily true, because the last point I want to bring up about this game is that kids can participate. Mm-hmm. And depending on how smart the kid is and how dumb and or drunk the adults are, they can rake up some serious points. Mm-hmm. And what is better when you're a kid than feeling smugly superior to a bunch of... really
small
drunk,
children?
Drunk,
I,
or dumb, I just, dumb adults.
I really, really love that Glenn Weldon's idea of a thing that brings people together is smug superiority and judgment.
Yeah, well, yes.
And drinking. Yeah, Trey Graham, talk to me about Common Ground.
I am going to question the premise a little bit, because I don't think any group of people can truly come together without choosing from among themselves a scapegoat, which is why my choice for this segment is the awkward story about something that happened to you in your youth.
Yeah, sure.
Which
yeah.
inevitably gets brought up somewhere around the third course and the third glass of whatever your chosen libation
we
is.
We sound like drunks. We're not. We're sounding like drunks today.
The one that we go back to often in my family, just, you know, because I brought this up, I figure I'm going to tell one on myself. The one where I decided that it was a good idea to hit my cousin, the babysitter, in the head with a meat tenderizer. Mm. She was not amused and disciplined me.
I see.
With a meat tenderizer.
with a golf club, actually.
I see.
She brings a meat tenderizer, you bring a golf club.
So you...
That's the Georgia way.
So you like the idea of sort of personal sharing as a way to bond people. I think there are families where that would work and families where that would end in tears.
Do not care for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're to draw a principle from that, it would be that, you know, sometimes you can get everybody to sort of throw something in about themselves. And I think the success of what you're talking about might be determined in many families by how much it was people telling on themselves versus people telling
on each other. Well, as Glenn sort of alluded to, I am from the Deep South. And, you know, as Florence King likes to say, Yankees put their crazy people up in the attic. We put them on the front porch so they can say hey to the neighbors. So, you know, when I tell the story about whacking my cousin with the meat tenderizer, she will usually step up to the plate and tell the one about her abusive husband and the night she tried to light him on fire.
Well, there you go. And what could be more? What could bring people
what
together?
What could be more pop
than
culture
that?
Than
happy,
that?
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
What could bring people together more than that? All right, Thompson, what do you got?
All right. Well, first of all, in the gatherings of a family member from different backgrounds, I highly recommend selecting and brutalizing an absent pariah. So
we've reached the same conclusion. You just won't do it to their face.
Yeah.
Right. No, this is key. This is key. This way no one gets hurt.
Okay.
Except that next Thanksgiving when everyone tells them what you did.
So if everybody wants to get together and talk crap, this is, I think, a noble and beautiful beautiful bonding
That's
exercise.
That's pop culture?
No, the thing is, this was my contribution in the, ooh, is it Scattergories or is it, you know, Balderdash?
Okay.
Wow.
I would like to put in a good word for football.
Yeah.
I'll keep my actual football 11-0 talk to a minimum, but it does come in extraordinarily handy when you are trying to talk to a very, very wide variety of people that you may or may not have anything in common with. Being a football fan, being a player of fantasy football comes in very handy, because if you find someone else who you have nothing in common with, but you can recite your fantasy teams, it is really, really super handy. I cannot tell you how many times I have been bailed out of what could have been really tense or awkward or unfortunate conversations.
You know, it is true. In our football watching experiment a few months ago, we did discover common ground in the commercials, if nothing else.
Right.
It was lusting after the shaving guy commercials.
It's true.
Thing.
It's true.
We found common ground in that, didn't we?
Well, three of us did.
The rest of us all did.
It comes in handy to have knowledge of sort of massive across-the-board cultural phenomena, whether it's American Idol or football or Survivor or, you know, something, you know, Harry Potter books, okay. Something that, like, lots and lots of people... You know, I've not read the Da Vinci Code, but I'm sure, like, it would be handy. You can run into millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of people who've read it, and you can discuss those things. The other one that I would throw out, in terms of those sort of across-the-board cultural phenomena, the new Rihanna single is freaking amazing.
Yellow diamonds in the light, and we're standing side by side, as a shadow crosses mine. What it takes to form a
you know, that's another thing.
Okay, left field. I thought you were going to go for, like, the Thanksgiving Day parade.
I'm talking about mass popular culture phenomena.
Okay.
I feel like everybody, just like everybody can agree on Adele, they can all get together and agree on how
everybody
it
can get together.
So something has to achieve saturation so that it can be so much like the weather that you can make boring small talk about it.
Yes, that is key.
Awesome.
That's well said. All right, well, I decided to bring a couple of TV examples, as I want to do. If you envision yourself in the living room, which preferably has enough seating, my first idea, it's funny, Trey just mentioned the parade. My first idea is the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, for the simple reason that nobody, like, loves it. Like, nobody's, like, very few people, I will say.
I was going to say, there are people.
There are certainly devotees, but few. You have a good chance that nobody in your family is, like, super incredibly excited about it. But everybody kind of knows what it is. It's not political. It doesn't necessarily...
It doesn't need contextualizing...
It doesn't threaten anybody's identity.
Well, there's no cultural identity that dates from the previous 20 years.
Exactly.
There are very few stakes. It's not like watching the Oscars. Right. It's like watching the VMAs.
Right.
Well, and at one point I was watching it and it was like, an ode to Sister Act.
Yeah. It's like, well, of course that's because it's...
I know it's on...
So I would say the parade...
Well, and everybody can make fun of parade banter because it is terrible.
Right. And that's the other thing. It gives everybody something that's fairly easy to make fun of in a gentle, harmless...
There is the added layer of schadenfreude because there are highly paid television personalities sitting in the cold commenting on it.
People who do not sit around spending their days figuring out, you know, smart alecky things to say can still often find something smart alecky to say about the parade. And you don't really feel like anybody's getting hurt because it's a one-day thing. So it's not like everybody's going to be like, but I'm a fan of the parade. How dare you? Like, I associate myself. So,
how dare you diss the Lady Gaga spider balloon?
So I sometimes feel like that can be a good choice. The other thing I'm going to make a case for is basic cable documentary / reality, like Mythbusters or Deadliest Catch, or the one that my sister and her kids and I spent a lot of time watching this Thanksgiving, Storage Wars, this is the one where the people go in and bid essentially mostly blind on a storage locker that's been abandoned. And then they have to go in and find out whether there's the stuff in it is worth anything. And you realize quickly, you're really just watching people gambling. You would see whether stuff was junk.
It's like, let's make a deal, but with people's hopes and dreams.
Exactly. But it's not terribly loaded. I find that what works for this is often things that nobody is incredibly excited about, but they can kind of hum along and provide a little, you know, a little entertainment. And obviously you would also spend some time ideally doing things that were a little more intensely family oriented, like having your nice meal or doing whatever else. But for the downtime, I think that works well. So this hopefully will be good advice for you, since there are, for many people, more holidays to come in the next month and a half. If you want to exchange ideas with other Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners, find your way to the Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH. For gracious sake, like us already, please.
and
you'll be able to chat with everybody about what you use to entertain your entire family so that you don't have to talk to them all the time.
Indeed.
Although, if you're lucky, like me, you enjoy talking to your family. Okay, speaking of things we enjoy, it is time for the final segment of our show, What is Making Us Happy Week? Trey Graham seems like he wants to start.
I do. There's a playwright, one of the most influential Irish playwrights of our day. His name is Enda Walsh, and he has a new project opening in New York. in collaboration with the director and the choreographer who were behind a particularly acclaimed piece of drama about the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, which was called Black Watch. The show begins performances, I guess, in a couple of weeks on November 15th. There's already talk about a Broadway transfer. Oh, I almost forgot. The music and lyrics are by some people I think we might have talked about on the show, Glenn Hansard and Marketa Irglova. Oh. It is the stage musical version of Once. And the buzz around it is terrifically strong. So keep your ears open for a feature that I believe is going to be on Morning Edition on this coming Tuesday, and read the papers for news of the musical Once. Fantastic.
So somebody picked that Glenn Hansard as the thing making them happy, and it was not me. Let the record show. It's like Glenn saying, what is making me happy today is the music of Clem Snide.
Oh, Stephen. So, Stephen, what is making you happy this week, if it's not that?
The music of Clem Snide.
Yeah, first of all, it is my dear mother's birthday.
Yay, Maggie Thompson.
She is Pop Culture Happy Hour's most deranged fan.
I don't know.
There might be a couple of others.
We got a handful.
We got a little
competition.
I'm not saying she doesn't have competition, yeah, but I think she's certainly my most deranged fan.
Right.
And she is delightful. She is turning an age that I cannot say out loud without also saying, woo!
Yeah.
During our week off, I made it to several movie theaters to get a jump start on what will ultimately be, I'm sure, an Oscar marathon by seeing Like Crazy and Marsha, 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 Marsha. both of which I enjoyed. My guess is that we will probably discuss them at a later date. Finally, I am just enormously excited that there was something called a Lady Gaga Thanksgiving on TV.
And Did you watch it?
That it exists.
Many people watched it.
And many, many people. Basically, my Twitter feed. I didn't have to watch it because I had Twitter.
Yeah.
It was
like all the gays in the universe came together.
Sometimes there is like a new piece of pop culture that is so instantly of its moment that it's going to seem dated like 6 months from now in a wonderful, wonderful way.
Like
we've talked about the movie Cool as Ice on this show before, and the fact is, if 5 years after that movie came out, it was like this movie could have been made 50 years ago on another planet, and that is how I feel about the existence of Lady Gaga.
I suspect that the Lady Gaga Thanksgiving Festival is going to be the Star Wars Christmas special of 2011.
I don't know. I didn't see it, but I did switch past it. There was a moment where she's just talking to some chef about how much she loves when he cooks for her. I mean, like that's not nearly weird enough. That's not nearly what I was hoping for from this thing.
It was too normal for you?
Yeah, it was way too normal.
I gotcha. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
All right, I think we can all agree the action movie is kind of long in the tooth these days. There's a formula to the action film. And that's what makes them satisfying. That's what makes them kind of tick all the boxes and get a reaction out of you, a satisfying ending. But more and more these days, that formula is showing, and people aren't really bothering to dress it up at all. So earlier this year, a film came out called Hannah. It's an action movie directed by Joe Wright, who is not known for action films. He directed Pride and Prejudice and Atonement.
Atonement, right, yeah.
And The Soloist, which is that Robert Downey Jr., Jamie Foxx.
Yeah.
So, the kind of prestige Oscar-baity, or at least in the case of The Soloist, purportedly
trying to be Oscar-baity.
And this movie, Hannah, is on demand now, and I remember the people I liked saying that they really liked it, so we gave it a shot over Thanksgiving. In a post-Buffy universe, it really shouldn't surprise anybody that making your hero a teenage girl will do some really surprising and interesting things to genre. In Buffy, it was horror. Here, it's the action film. I don't want to say too much about what this film's about. The basic premise is that Hannah is a girl raised by her father as an assassin in a remote cabin just below the Arctic Circle. It's on demand now, as I say, and many on-demand services give you the option to watch the trailer before you see the film, just to make up your mind. Do not do that, because it not only ruins a really good moment near the beginning, it also ruins the film's final image. Mm-hmm. I've gone back and forth with a friend of mine, a friend of the show, Chris Klimek, who is a connoisseur of the action movie, and he feels about this film that it's a Bourne wannabe, that it's very 90s. He's being distracted, in my opinion, by the Chemical Brothers soundtrack, which, he's got a point there. But as I watched this thing, it just struck me that making the character a teenage girl takes all the familiar action movie elements that we've seen badass white dudes do millions and millions of times and really changes them. The car chases, the fight scenes, the second act hero betrayal slash villain reveal that always happens, the romance thread, all of that went off in these weird, really idiosyncratic directions that didn't make action movie sense, but made their own kind of sense. So it's an action film, but it's very stylish. It's weirdly sly, and it just ended in a place I did not see coming. So I recommend it, Hannah.
Very good. All right. So here's what's making me happy this week. I got two things. First of all, I think it is a crying shame that we have managed to do all of our Muppet talk and other people have done their Muppet talk, and not enough people are talking about the Toy Story short that is running in front of the Muppets, which I thought was hysterically funny. Really, really loved it. It's another one that is saturated with jokes, so that if you, when they start going through all the little toys that are in it, if you don't think one is funny, you'll think the next one is funny. There are a whole bunch of just very quick fire little visual jokes. You can tell that they just sat around and came up with like 600 of these, and then they picked the ones they liked the best. So I really, really like it. I've seen it a couple times now. I am sure it will be Oscar nominated in animated shorts, and it will deserve it. I'm very, very enthusiastic about the Toy Story short. So I just want to say, you know, I love you, belt buckle. The other thing, I'm going to go with a very simple, you know, cute, cool website thing, which in this case is Animals Talking in All Caps, which is a site that I was directed to this week, and it's just Animals Talking in All Caps. If you liked F.U. Penguin, it has much in common with F.U. Penguin, but the specific conceit is that all of the, rather than talking to the animals, which is often what F.U. Penguin was doing, this is the animals talking. And so, for instance, there is one that I'm looking at right now that has a giant spider sitting on top of a sort of old flip phone. And in all caps, it just says, "Mary, are you serious? This thing doesn't even have T9. How long have you had this phone? Did you still have a beeper when you bought this phone? I can literally align the Hubble telescope with my phone, and it takes pictures so clear I can deposit checks with them. Does this thing even text, or am I just dialing a 52-number sequence? You probably have an awesome Laserdisc collection at home, don't you?" And it's in all caps, and you see a spider sitting on top of a phone, and somehow the genius of this is in the marriage of all these elements. I strongly recommend the website Animals Talking in All Caps. I can't really explain it any better than that, but I will link to it.
How could you?
All caps is how they feel inside.
Oh, that too. Yeah. What Trey is quoting there is the Tumblr from the guy who allegedly taught his cat to use I am, and he and his cat I am all day, and the cat says, "Rick, Rick, 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 Rick," until Rick answers him, and then they have very, very funny exchanges. We'll link to that too. It's a close relative of Animals Talking in All Caps. And that brings us to the end of our show for this week. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. That's STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. Trey with an E. Graham like, well, Martha Graham, no.
Yes.
Yes.
Take that.
And you can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can also follow our esteemed producer and Muppet fan, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music. We love it. It makes us happy. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Good to see you again after the holiday.
Always a pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.